Around these parts, we spell global economic forecast with three little letters, I, M, and F. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, the 9th of April. Today, good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin on this Tuesday with a restatement of our every now and then observation that this is a global economy and we are kind of stuck with it come what may. And when what is coming is generally good, rising growth and economic optimism, good, fine. When what's coming is less growth and some small degree of economic pessimism, well, you got to play the hand you're dealt, right? And the global economic hand we are being dealt today comes to us from the International Monetary Fund, IMF, get it, which is out with its latest forecast on the global economy. Growth, yes, but less of it. The IMF's third forecast of slower growth in 6 months. Geeta Gopinath is the chief economist for the IMF. Dr. Gopinath, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You called the global economy this morning in some of your commentary. You said we're at a delicate moment. How come? Why?
So global growth is projected to slow down to 3.3% in 2019. Now, we expect a recovery in 2020, and, that recovery is precarious. So that's the sense in which this is a delicate moment, because if any of the downside risks that we worry about materialize, the recovery that we're expecting may not come about.
Okay, why are you expecting recovery if it's so precarious? Seems like a gutsy call to make.
Well, what we've certainly seen is a substantial amount of policy accommodation around the world. I mean, all of the major central banks have shifted to a more accommodative stance. We've seen China put in a fair amount of fiscal and monetary stimulus. We've certainly seen some improvement in trade tensions between U.S. and China, at least compared to 2018. So all of those factors, would help growth going forward. And we expect to see some recoveries in stressed economies like Argentina and Turkey. So that's where our forecast is coming from.
So we've got low rates, the accommodative policy that you mentioned. But we do still have the specter of a no-deal Brexit or whatever's going to happen over there. We have ongoing U.S.-China trade talks, which, again, who knows what's going to happen over there. Get me then to your downside risk that you mentioned.
I mean, one of our main downside risks remains an escalation in trade tensions, maybe with other countries, in other sectors like autos. We would like to see a resolution of Brexit with an agreement that's not a no-deal Brexit. These would be some of the important policy missteps to be avoided.
Let me get a little more specific. Are you talking American trade policy movements here?
We are talking about, the U.S.-China trade tensions, weakened growth, weakened investment, reduced business confidence. So the question is what happens going forward from the U.S. side, from any retaliation, which is why we say that this is a delicate moment and it's important for policymakers to avoid missteps.
Let me just ask, since you mentioned central banks, and listeners will hear elsewhere in the program about the independence of central banks, and since you led with it in your answer, how critical are central banks and the proper functioning thereof to the future health of the global economy?
I mean, central bank policies they've taken recently, the independence of the central bank are all hugely important for the health of the global economy. They've played an important role in reducing downside risks that were showing up towards the end of 2018. And so it is important that they remain independent, they remain data-driven, and the policies are well communicated.
So you've been on the job since the 1st of January. How are you liking it so far?
It's been a lot of fun. It's been great.
Dr. Geeta Gopinath, she's the new-ish chief economist of the International Monetary Fund, out with her global forecast this morning. Dr. Gopinath, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
She mentioned a no-deal Brexit, by the way, without getting into the current state of play over in the UK, because, frankly, one loses track. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said this today in congressional testimony, quote, "I think at this point," the secretary said, "we need to be prepared for a hard Brexit as a very realistic outcome," end of quote. Hard Brexit, of course, is a no-deal Brexit. Again, who knows what the what over there. On Wall Street today, honestly, kind of, man, nobody was really wild about that IMF forecast. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. follow-up now to our story last week, I guess, about the most profitable company on the planet, Saudi Arabia's national oil company, Saudi Aramco, it's called. We told you about it because they were going to go to the capital markets, sell off some bonds, and had opened their books, at least partway, to see whether investors wanted in. And hoo boy, did they. Interest in Aramco bonds came in such a stampede that investors were okay taking a really, really small return, a yield in bond market talk, the interest those bonds pay, in return for letting the company use investors' money. And as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, despite the human rights controversies surrounding the Saudi kingdom, the markets, they don't seem so worried.
There's a big range of bonds available to investors. The more risk they take, the more interest or yield they get. On one end, there are junk bonds, says Georgetown finance professor Jim Angel. Companies on the edge.
You may not get any money back, but in the meantime, if they did pay off, you'd get a huge return.
Saudi Aramco's at the other extreme. A giant profit machine backed by a country, it offered low yield. It's safe as the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia's bonds. And investors couldn't get enough. Aramco set a goal of borrowing $10 billion.
As of yesterday, the order book was $60 billion. I just saw a report earlier today that it was at $100 billion. So in other words, there are plenty of investors who are willing to lend Aramco money on the same terms as they lend money to the Saudi government.
That's a great signal for Saudi Arabia, which owns Aramco. It wants to raise money to invest in new sectors besides oil and to convince the rest of the world that its companies are well run, says Stephen Kopitz at Princeton Energy Advisors.
If you want a modern economy and if you're particularly looking to move past, you know, an oil-based economy in Saudi Arabia, you slowly have to be edging towards international standards of governance.
This has been the kingdom's plan for a while, but it was thrown into serious doubt last fall by the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, says energy scholar Valerie Marcel at Chatham House, a British think tank.
The government was very keen to attract foreign investment, and now they're back in the good graces of the world. They're no longer the pariah state.
Today's big-time bond sale is rekindling expectations that Saudi Aramco might go public and let investors buy company stock, too. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
It will surely not have escaped your attention that April the 15th is this coming Monday, which means unless you live in Massachusetts and Maine, right, where the third Monday in April is the Patriots' Day holiday, taxes are due. And if it has escaped your attention, well, the Internal Revenue Service would like a word with you. One of the promises of the GOP's 2017 tax cuts, under which this is the first filing season, is that filing our taxes is going to be simpler, the math a little easier and the forms a little shorter. Thing is, most Americans use tax software or an accountant to file their taxes. And yes, sure, a lot of that is convenience, but there is a dash of fear in it as well. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that one.
Look, I get it. It's hard to make taxes approachable. Courtney Paquette is trying, though, by turning her classroom into a tax game show.
Which celebrity is generally considered to have owed the most in back taxes at $14 million? Is it singer Mark Anthony?
Paquette is a teacher at Winooski High School in Vermont, near Burlington. She's quizzing the students in her personal finance class, which is mandatory for graduation. She recently taught them how to file their taxes using the IRS forms, the 1040, the 1099, not TurboTax or H&R Block. They grumbled and groaned, said things like, I hate taxes.
I think it's just the instant reaction based off of the messaging that we have as a country about taxes being something that is so terrifying.
You can fill out and submit those IRS forms on paper or on the IRS website, but most people don't. According to the IRS, nearly 90% of U.S. taxpayers pay a professional or use software to file. And there are situations where that's a no-brainer, if you own a business or have complicated investments, for instance. But Joe Thorndike at the publisher Tax Analysts says for many taxpayers, that's not the case.
I mean, the irony here is that for lots of people, filing taxes is not complicated. I mean, if all you earn are wages, for the most part, then your tax return is really quite simple.
You're going to fill out more forms when you go to the doctor. So why do so few people do their taxes on their own? A big reason? Fear.
You're just not sure whether you're doing it right. And on the far side of doing it wrong is potentially jail, you know, or at least some really bad fines.
And that gets drilled into our heads. The IRS is this sort of boogeyman that's going to come arrest you, garnish your wages, take your house. Julie Jaskirski lives in Chicago, and she uses tax software, says the IRS is too scary.
I don't want to say like Big Brother, but kind of like they have like all this power, like they'll send their people after you, or like, I don't know, but I'm afraid to mess up.
The other kind of fear at play here, that you'll leave money on the table. Maybe you don't know about some deduction that could get you a bigger refund, but tax software or an accountant does. And while there are some free tax prep options, there are limitations. Juliana Hansen, who lives in Maine, realized that recently. She was using a free version of TurboTax when it said, hey, here's a $200 tax credit you qualify for. One catch.
You need to upgrade to the $40 version of TurboTax to get this $200. They were like waving it in front of my face, but like you have to pay us now, which felt really rude.
Hansen could have gotten this credit on the IRS forms for free by making a few extra calculations, but she paid because part of this is about convenience. Often it's easier to pay someone else to be the expert. Joe Thorndike at Tax Analysts says he gets that. Even he uses TurboTax. But he thinks there is a bigger societal cost when Americans don't know how to fill out a 1040 or what's even on it. They become sort of disconnected from the tax code.
And the downside of that is that the tax system could use a lot of improvements, but it dulls our outrage in a way that makes those improvements less likely.
Courtney Paquette, the teacher in Vermont, wants her students to have the ability to file on their own. And if someday they do use software or an accountant, they'll know enough to double-check their return. For what it's worth, she says her students warm up to the tax forms quickly. By the way, the answer to that question about the celebrity who owed $14 million in back taxes? Nicolas Cage. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It may simply dissuade them from going to their healthcare practitioner and even asking the questions.
Drug prices and the difference they can make. But first, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 190 points today, 0.7%, 26,150. The NASDAQ off 44 points, 0.5%, 79.09. The S&P 500 down 17 points, 0.6%. 28 and 78. American Airlines revised its outlook downward, blaming in part the grounding of its Boeing 737 MAX airplanes. That's in America stock down 1.6%. Today, let us stay with airline stocks, as some of them are reporting quarterly earnings soon. Delta down 1.3% today. JetBlue down 1.4%. United also down about 0.4%. Hawaiian Holdings, parent company of, yes, Hawaiian Airlines, bucked the trend up nearly 6.4% as it raised its outlook for the quarter. Boeing, the proximate cause of this moment in aviation distress, down 1.5% today. Percent and a half is another way to say that. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.50%. 2.5% doesn't really do it in bonds because that tenth matters, actually. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Let me do a quick callback to my interview with Geeta Gopinath, the IMF's chief economist, up at the top of the program. Specifically, that bit about central banks, the Federal Reserve, just for instance, and their role in the global economy. Critical is the short version of her answer. I asked it because central banks and their independence are under some pressure right now. Here in the United States, as we have reported from President Trump directly and his top economic advisors, but elsewhere as well. And as some new research from Fitch Ratings out this week makes clear, that pressure could come with some economic costs. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is on that one.
When the economy slows, it can be tempting for politicians to look for someone to blame.
And the central bank is an obvious somebody.
Barry Eichengreen at the University of California, Berkeley, says you can see this in countries like India, Turkey, Argentina.
What's new is that the United States has joined the crowd.
The Federal Reserve is the world's most important central bank. So James McCormick with Fitch Ratings says if it's seen as coming under this kind of pressure, he expects other central banks will too.
There's an increasing amount of commentary coming from political leaders directed towards central banks and encouraging them to adopt easier monetary policies,
aka lowering interest rates, or even non-traditional ideas, like allowing the Fed to fund government spending by printing more money. McCormick says as countries face slowing growth and growing debt,
the temptation, as I said, will be to look to central banks for at least part of the solution, and that would be to allow inflation to run a little bit higher.
A little extra inflation may not sound so scary, says Kent Kuttner, an econ professor at Williams College, but it can easily get out of hand.
If the central bank is under pressure in a couple of years prior to elections to get the economy to run faster, and then in the years after the election experiences a hangover, then you can see how this is going to set in motion a boom-bust cycle.
Kuttner says it's really risky to prioritize short-term political goals over long-term economic stability. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
This item today from the Marketplace desk of correlation is not causation, except maybe sometimes it is. Bank of America said today it's going to bump its minimum wage for hourly workers. Starting May the 1st, B of A is going to pay $2 an hour more, $17, a $20 an hour minimum wage in a couple of years. And there have been minimum wage increases elsewhere lately as well. Amazon's at $15, Costco the same. Target just announced it's going to $13, a couple of more next year. Federal minimum wage, by the way, $7.25 an hour. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman looked into what's going on here, and it comes with this three-word hint, and therein lies the correlation-causation thing. Here's the three words. Tight labor market. Here's Mitchell.
Bank of America is setting a high bar, higher than leading big-box retailers, way higher than the federal minimum wage. Daniel Zhao at jobsite Glassdoor says bank tellers are making 6.2% more than a year ago.
Bank tellers are not just distributing cash or things that an ATM could do. Banks are realizing that they actually do need tellers. They need humans to interact with their customers.
10 years into the economic recovery, says Nick Bunker at Indeed.com, competition for workers is fierce.
There's fewer and fewer unemployed workers and workers out of the labor force who would want work. So employers are needing to increasingly bid up wages.
Just check out these annual increases in the Glassdoor survey. Cashier up 5.5%. Bartender, like Mike Murray, up 13.5%.
Back in October of 2017, I started out at 12 an hour plus tips. By the middle of last year, I was at 17 an hour plus tips.
Murray's 30. He pours drinks and manages a popular brew pub in the Seattle area. He graduated college into the Great Recession. Things have gotten better.
There's more demand for skilled people who will stay around, so that gives me a lot of leverage.
Small businesses are on the losing end of that equation, says Ann Petrick at Vistage, a business advisory firm.
We're hearing a lot of CEOs saying they have challenges with even getting people to show up for the first day of employment.
Employers that can't afford 17 or 20 an hour, they're offering perks, tuition reimbursement, or training to get workers to stick around. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Hey, so you like charts, don't you? I know you do. We've got one for you. Hourly average pay at other big companies, Walmart included, online at marketplace.org. Thank you. This was one of those not terribly fun days to be running a company that Congress has taken an interest in. The Senate Finance Committee had a bunch of companies that manage prescription drug plans in the spotlight today. Pharmacy benefit managers, they're called, getting some heat over their role in the high cost of prescription drugs. That idea, drug prices and how high they are, is of a moment in Washington right now. There are bills being drafted to match drug prices here to drug prices charged overseas. And the White House is expected to finalize a new rule soon that would oblige television ads for prescription drugs to include list prices for those drugs, the idea being that transparency is ultimately going to lead to lower consumer costs. It's an idea not without controversy, but as Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, one big drug company is already on board, at least for one of its popular medications.
There's a new TV commercial for the blood thinner Xarelto. It's like other Xarelto ads except for one thing. At the end, there's a graphic with pricing information while you hear this.
To learn more about cost and how Janssen can help, visit Xarelto.com.
The graphic includes the drug's list price and what the company says most consumers actually pay out of pocket for Xarelto after insurance, rebates, and discounts. Scott White is the company chair for Janssen's North American pharmaceutical business, a subsidiary of Johnson & Johnson, the company that sells Xarelto. He says the company wanted to get in front of the new rules.
When this debate first started around the inclusion of price, we made a decision to conduct wide-span research into understanding what information is going to be most meaningful to patients and consumers.
What Johnson & Johnson thinks is most meaningful is what's clearly more prominent in the Xarelto ad, that most users will pay between $0 and $47 a month. Less noticeable, the list price of $448. Price is something Jill Burns of suburban Minneapolis really pays attention to. Her 19-year-old son has type 1 diabetes. Her family's on a high-deductible insurance plan, so for the first 3 months of each year, she has to pay full price for her son's insulin. $1,800 a month. She's in favor of any commercial that spells out list price.
If it says $10,000, people are going to freak out about that. It may stop companies from just charging whatever they can. I just feel like transparency and openness really never hurts anyone.
Peter Bach agrees. He's an oncologist and director of the Center for Health Policy and Outcomes at Sloan Kettering in New York.
The only step here is allowing patients to see how outrageously priced some of these drugs are. And some activated patients will then be able to go on the internet and say, gee, this price is three times what it is for the same drug in Germany. Why is that?
Knowledge of a drug's list price doesn't have any magic powers, says John Bigelow at the Coalition for Healthcare Communication, a pharmaceutical industry lobbying group. In fact, he says this information could have dangerous consequences.
If a patient gets the message from a television advertisement that some therapy is going to cost a huge amount of money, it may simply dissuade them from going to their healthcare practitioner and even asking the questions.
The Trump administration believes disclosing list price will stimulate competition, leading to lower prices. Stacey Duzetzina doubts that.
That might put some pressure on prices and price increases, but it really fundamentally doesn't seem like it would matter.
Duzetzina teaches health policy at Vanderbilt. She says ads with list prices won't matter because drug companies have a lot of pricing leverage. Michelle Mello at Stanford Law School says there's another problem with this proposed rule.
Whereas there's not much controversy when a company is required to disclose the amount of the interest rate on your loan or how your attorney fees are going to be calculated, there's a lot of controversy about whether the list price of a drug is meaningful price information or if it actually verges over into the misleading.
If the rule is finalized, there's a good chance Big Pharma will sue to stop it. Or we might just see more drug companies do what Johnson & Johnson did and comply voluntarily, hoping to turn the rule into a selling point. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Final note on the way out today, news you can use department, which I will preface by saying I went to fill up last night, and while I wasn't looking, a gallon of regular somehow hit $3.99. Thank you, recent oil rally. But anyway, here's the actual item. According to a survey by the gasoline app GasBuddy that I saw in USA Today, Monday, it turns out, is the best, that is, cheapest day of the week to buy gas. Less traffic to the pumps, it seems, on Mondays. Fridays, in the afternoon specifically, are worst, stations bumping up prices ahead of the weekend, which makes sense in a capitalism kind of way. All right, we're done. Dow Industrials off 190 points today, 0.7%. The NASDAQ down 44, that's about 0.5%. S&P 500 down 17 points, about 0.6%. Our digital and on-demand team includes Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Barbara Platts, Brian Ronahan, Arjuna Soriano, and Tony Wagner. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Star Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow. Bye. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.